Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Chapter 9 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Rinehart. Elizabeth had gone about all day with a smile on her lips and a sort of exaltation in her eyes. She had, girl fashion, gone over and over the totally uneventful evening they had spent together, remembering small speeches and gestures, what he had said and she had answered. She had, for instance, mentioned Claire Rossiter very casually, oh, very, very casually. And he had said, "Claire Rossiter? Oh, yes, the tall blonde girl, isn't she?" She was very happy. He had not seemed to find her too young or particularly immature. He had asked her opinion on quite important things and listened carefully when she replied. She felt, though, that she knew about one-tenth as much as he did, and she determined to read very seriously from that time on. Her mother, missing her that afternoon, found her curled up in the library, beginning the first volume of Gibbon's Rome, with an air of determined concentration and wearing her best summer frock. She did not intend to depend purely on Gibbon's Rome, evidently. "Are you expecting anyone, Elizabeth?" she asked, with the frank directness characteristic of mothers. And Elizabeth, fixing a date in her mind with terrible firmness, looked up absently and said, "No one in particular." At 3 o'clock, with a slight headache from concentration, she went upstairs and put up her hair again, rather high this time, to make her feel taller. Of course it was not likely he would come. He was very busy. So many people depended on him. It must be wonderful to be like that, to have people needing one, and looking out of the door and saying, "I think I see him coming now." Nevertheless, when the postman rang, her heart gave a small leap and then stood quite still. When Annie slowly mounted the stairs, she was already on her feet, but it was only a card announcing, "Mrs. Sayre, Wednesday, May 15th, luncheon at 1:30. However, at 4:30 the bell rang again, and a masculine voice informed Annie, a moment later, that it would put its overcoat here, because lately a dog had eaten a piece out of it and got most awful indigestion. The time it took Annie to get up the stairs again gave her a moment, so that she could breathe more naturally, and she went down very deliberately and so dreadfully poised that at first he thought she was not glad to see him. "I came, you see," he said. "I intended to wait until tomorrow, but I had a little time. But if you're doing anything..." "I was reading Gibbon's Rome," she informed him. "I think everyone should know it, don't you?" "Good heavens, what for?" he inquired. "I don't know." They looked at each other, and suddenly they laughed. "I wanted to improve my mind," she explained. "I felt last night that you know so many things, and that I was frightfully stupid." "Do you mean to say," he asked, aghast, "that I... Great Scott!" Settled in the living room, they got back rather quickly to their status of the night before, and he was moved to confession. "I didn't really intend to wait until tomorrow," he said. "I got up with the full intention of coming here today, if I did it over the wreck of my practice. At 11 o'clock this morning I held up a consultation 10 minutes to go to Yardsley's and buy a tie for this express purpose. Perhaps you have noticed it already." "I have indeed. It's a wonderful tie." "Neat, but not gaudy, eh?" He grinned at her happily. "You know, you might steer me a bit about my ties. I have the taste of an African savage. I nearly bought a purple one with red stripes. And Aunt Lucy thinks I should wear white lawn like David." They talked, those small, highly significant nothings, which are only the barrier behind which go on the eager questionings and unspoken answers of youth and love. They had known each other for years, had exchanged the same give and take of neighborhood talk when they met as now. Today nothing was changed, and everything. Then out of a clear sky he said, "I may be going away before long, Elizabeth." He was watching her intently. She had a singular feeling that behind this, as behind everything that afternoon, was something not spoken. Something that related to her. Perhaps it was because of his tone.
"You don't mean not to stay?"
"No. I want to go back to Wyoming, where I was born. Only for a few weeks." And in that "only for a few weeks" there lay some of the unspoken things. That he would miss her and come back quickly to her. That she would miss him, and that subconsciously he knew it. And behind that, too, a promise. He would come back to her. "Only for a few weeks," he repeated. "I thought perhaps if you wouldn't mind my writing to you now and then. I write a rotten hand, you know. Most medical men do."
"I should like it very much," she said primly.
She felt suddenly very lonely, as though he had already gone, and slightly resentful, not at him, but at the way things happened. And then, too, everyone knew that once a Westerner, always a Westerner. The West always called its children. Not that she put it that way. But she had a sort of vision, gained from the moving pictures, of a country of wide spaces and tall mountains, where men wore quaint clothing, and the women rode wild horses and had the dash she knew she lacked. She was stirred by a vague jealousy.
"You may never come back," she said casually. "After all, you were born there, and we must seem very quiet to you."
"Quiet!" he exclaimed. "You are heavenly restful and comforting. You," he checked himself and got up, "then I'm to write, and you are to make out as much of my scrawl as you can and answer. Is that right?"
"I'll write to you all the town gossip."
"If you do," he threatened her, "you're to write me what you're doing and all about yourself. Remember, I'll be counting on you." And if their voices were light, there was in both of them the sense of a pact made, of a bond that was to hold them, like clasped hands, against their coming separation. It was rather anticlimacteric, after that, to have him acknowledge that he didn't know exactly when he could get away. She went with him to the door and stood there, her soft hair blowing as he got into the car. When he looked back, as he turned the corner, she was still there. He felt very happy, affable, and he picked up an elderly village woman with her and went considerably out of his way to take her home. He got back to the office at 6:30 to find a red-eyed Minnie in the hall. End of chapter 9.
Chapter 10 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Rinehart. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. At 5:30 that afternoon, David had let himself into the house with his latchkey, hung up his overcoat on the old walnut hat-rack, and went into his office. The strain of the days before had told on him, and he felt weary and not entirely well. He had fallen asleep in his buggy, and had wakened to find old Nettie drawing him slowly down the main street of the town, pursuing an erratic but homeward course, while the people on the pavements watched and smiled. He went into his office, closed the door, and then, on the old leather couch with its sagging springs, he stretched himself out to finish his nap. Almost immediately, however, the doorbell rang, and a moment later Minnie opened his door.
"Gentleman to see you, Dr. David."
He got up clumsily and settled his collar. Then he opened the door into his waiting room.
"Come in," he said resignedly.
A small, dapper man in precisely the type of clothes David most abominated, and wearing light-colored spats, rose from his chair and looked at him with evident surprise.
"I'm afraid I've made a mistake. A Dr. Livingstone left his seat number for calls at the box office of the Annex Theater last night, the Happy Valley Company, but he was a younger man.
David stiffened, but he surveyed his visitor impassively from under his shaggy white eyebrows.
"I haven't been in a theater for a dozen years, sir."
Gregory was convinced that he had made a mistake. Like Lewis Bassett, the very unlikeliness of Jud Clark being connected with the domestic atmosphere and quiet respectability of the old house made him feel intrusive and absurd. He was about to apologize and turn away when he thought of something. "There are two names on your sign. The other one, was he by any chance at the theater last night?"
"I think I shall have to have a reason for these inquiries," David said slowly. He was trying to place Gregory, to fit him into the situation, straining back over 10 years of security, racking his memory without result. "Just what have you come to find out?" he asked, as Gregory turned and looked around the room. "The other Dr. Livingstone is your brother?"
"My nephew."
Gregory shot a sharp glance at him, but all he saw was an elderly man with heavy white hair and fierce shaggy eyebrows, a portly and dignified elderly gentleman, rather resentfully courteous. "Sorry to trouble you," he said. "I suppose I've made a mistake. Is your nephew at home?"
"No."
"May I see a picture of him, if you have one?" David's wild impulse was to smash Gregory to the earth, to annihilate him. His collar felt tight, and he pulled it away from his throat.
"Not unless I know why you want to see it."
"He is tall, rather spare, and he took a young lady to the theater last night," Gregory persisted.
"He answers that description. What of it?"
"And he is your nephew?"
"My brother's son," David said steadily.
Somehow it began to dawn on him that there was nothing inimical in this strange visitor, that he was anxious and ill at ease. There was, indeed, something almost beseeching in Gregory's eyes, as though he stood ready to give confidence for confidence, and more than that, a sort of not unfriendly stubbornness, as though he had come to do something he meant to do.
"Sit down," he said, relaxing somewhat. "Certainly my nephew is making no secret of the fact that he went to the theater last night. If you'll tell me who you are..."
But Gregory did not sit down. He stood where he was and continued to eye David intently.
"I don't know just what it conveys to you, Doctor, but I am Beverly Carlyle's brother."
David lowered himself into his chair. His knees were suddenly weak under him, but he was able to control his voice.
"I see," he said, and waited.
"Something happened last night at the theater. It may be important. I'd have to see your nephew in order to find out if it is. I can't afford to make a mistake." David's ruddy color had faded. He opened a drawer of his desk and produced a copy of the photograph of Dick in his uniform.
"Maybe this will help you."
Gregory studied it carefully, carrying it to the window to do so. When he confronted David again, he was certain of himself and his errand for the first time, and his manner had changed.
"Yes," he said significantly, "it does."
He placed the photograph on the desk and, sitting down, drew his chair close to David's.
"I'll not use any names, Doctor. I think you know what I'm talking about. I was sure enough last night. I'm certain now."
David nodded. "Go on."
"We'll start like this. God knows I don't want to make any trouble, but I'll put a hypothetical case. Suppose that a man, when drunk, commits a crime and then disappears. Suppose he leaves behind him a bad record and an enormous fortune. Suppose that he then reforms and becomes a useful citizen and everything is buried."
Dr. David listened stonily. Gregory lowered his voice.
"Suppose there's a woman mixed up in that situation. Not guiltily, but there's a lot of talk. And suppose she lives it down for 10 years and then goes back to her profession. In a play the families take the children to see and makes good. It isn't hard to suppose that neither of those two people wants the thing revived, is it?"
David cleared his throat.
"You mean, then, that there is danger of such a revival?"
"I think there is," Gregory said bitterly. "I recognized this man last night and called a fellow who knew him in the old days, Saunders, our stage manager, and a newspaper man named Bassett wormed it out of Saunders. You know what that means?"
David heard him clearly, but as though from a great distance.
"You can see how it appears to Bassett. If he's found it, it's the big story of a lifetime. I thought he'd better be warned."
When David said nothing but sat holding tight to the arms of his old chair, Gregory reached for his hat and got up.
"The thing for him to do," he said, "is to leave town for a while. This Bassett is a hound hog on a scent. They all are. He is Bassett of the Times Republican. And he took Judd. He took your nephew's automobile license number."
Still David sat silent, and Gregory moved to the door.
Get him away, tonight if you can."
"Thank you," David said. His voice was thick. "I appreciate your coming." He got up dizzily as Gregory said good evening and went out. The room seemed very dark and unsteady and not familiar. So this was what had happened after all the safe years. A man could work and build and pray, but if his house was built on the sand... As the outer door closed, David fell to the floor with a crash. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Rinehart. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Bassett lounged outside the neat privet hedge, which it was Harrison Miller's custom to clip with his own bachelor hands, and waited. And as he waited, he tried to imagine what was going on inside, behind the neatly curtained windows of the old brick house. He was tempted to ring the bell again, pretend to have forgotten something, and perhaps happen in on what might be drama of a rather high order. What, supposing the man was Clark after all, was fairly sure to be drama. He discarded the idea, however, and began again his interested survey of the premises. Whoever conceived this sort of haven for Clark, if it were Clark, had shown considerable shrewdness. The town fairly smelt of respectability, the tree-shaded streets, the children in socks and small, crisp-laundered garments, the houses set back, each in its square of shaved lawn, all peaceful, middle-class, and unexciting. The last town in the world for Judson Clark, the last profession, the last house, this shabby old brick before him. He smiled rather grimly, as he reflected that if Gregory had been right in his identification, he was, beyond those windows at that moment, very possibly warning Clark against himself. Gregory would know his type that he never let go. He drew himself up a little. The house door opened and Gregory came out, turning toward the station. Bassett caught up with him and put a hand on his arm. "Well," he said cheerfully, "it was, wasn't it?" Gregory stopped dead and stared at him. Then, "Old dog Tray," he said sneeringly. "If your brain was as good as your nose, Bassett, you'd be a whale of a newspaper man." "Don't bother about my brain. It's working fine today, anyhow. Well, what had he to say for himself?" Gregory's mind was busy, and he had had a moment to pull himself together. "We both get off together," he said more amiably. "That fellow isn't Judd Clark and never was. He's a doctor and the nephew of the old doctor there. They're in practice together." "Did you see them both?" "Yes." Bassett eyed him. Either Gregory was a good actor or the whole trail ended there after all. He himself had felt, after his interview with Dick, that the scent was false. And there was this to be said. Gregory had been in the house scarcely 10 minutes, long enough to acknowledge a mistake, but hardly long enough for any dramatic identification. He was keenly disappointed, but he had had long experience of disappointment, and after a moment he only said, "Well, that's that. He certainly looked like Clark to me." "I'll say he did." "Rather surprised him, didn't you?" "Oh, he was all right," Gregory said. "I didn't tell him anything, of course." Bassett looked at his watch. "I was after you, all right," he said cheerfully. "But if I was barking up the wrong tree, I'm done. I don't have to be hit on the head to make me stop. Come and have a soda water on me," he finished amiably. "There's no train until 7. But Gregory refused. "No, thanks. I'll wander on down to the station and get a paper." The reporter smiled. Gregory was holding a grudge against him for a bad night and a bad day. "All right," he said affably. "I'll see you at the train. I'll walk about a bit." He turned and started back up the street again, walking idly. His chagrin was very real. He hated to be fooled, and fooled he had been. Gregory was not the only one who had lost a night's sleep. Then, unexpectedly, he was hailed from the curbstone, and he saw with amazement that it was Dick Livingstone. "Take you anywhere?" Dick asked. "How's the headache?" "Better, thanks." Bassett stared at him. "No, I'm just walking around until train time.
Are you starting out or going home at this hour?"
"Going home."
"Well, glad the head's better." He drove on, leaving the reporter gazing after him. So Gregory had been lying. He hadn't seen this chap at all. Then why? He walked on, turning this new phase of the situation over in his mind. Why this elaborate fiction if Gregory had merely gone in, waited for 10 minutes, and come out again? It wasn't reasonable. It wasn't logical. Something had happened inside that house to convince Gregory that he was right. He had seen somebody or something. He hadn't needed to lie. He could have said frankly that he had seen no one. But no, he had built up a fabric carefully calculated to throw Bassett off the scent. He saw Dick stop in front of the house, get out and enter. And coming to a decision, he followed him and rang the doorbell. For a long time, no one answered. Then the maid of the afternoon opened the door, her eyes red with crying, and looked at him with hostility. "Dr. Richard Livingstone?" "You can't see him." "It's important." "Well, you can't see him. Dr. David has just had a stroke. He's in the office now, on the floor." She closed the door on him, and he turned and went away. It was all clear to him. Gregory had seen, not Clark, but the older man, had told him and gone away. And under the shock, the older man had collapsed. That was sad. It was very sad. But it was also extremely convincing. He sat up late that night again, running over the entries in his notebook. The old story, as he pieced it out, ran like this. It had been 12 years ago when, according to the old files, Clark had financed Beverly Carlyle's first starring venture. He had apparently started out in the beginning only to give her the publicity she needed. In devising it, however, he had shown a sort of boyish recklessness and ingenuity that had caught the interest of the press and set newspaper men to chuckling wherever they got together. He had got together a dozen or so of young men like himself, wealthy, idle, and reckless with youth, and headed by him they had made the exploitation of the young star an occupation. The newspapers referred to the star and her constellation as Beverly Carlyle and her Broadway beauties. It had been unvicious, young, and highly entertaining, and it had cost Judson Clark his membership in his father's conservative old clubs. For a time it livened the theatrical world with escapades that were harmless enough, if sensational. Then after a time, newspaper row began to whisper that young Clark was in love with the girl. The Broadway beauties broke up after a wild farewell dinner. The audiences ceased to expect a row of a dozen youths, all dressed alike with gardenias in their buttonholes, and perhaps red neckties with their evening suits, to rise in their boxes on the star's appearance and solemnly bow. And the star herself lost a little of the anxious look she frequently wore. The story went, after a while, that Judson Clark had been refused and was taking his refusal badly. Reporters saw him, carelessly dressed, outside the stage door waiting, and the story went that the girl had thrown him over, money and all, for her leading man. One thing was clear. Clark, not a drinker before, had taken to drinking hard, and after a time and some unpleasant scenes, probably, she refused to see him any more. When the play closed in June 1911, she married Howard Lucas, her leading man, his third wife. Lucas had been not a bad chap, a good-looking, rather negligible man, given to all-day Sunday poker, carefully valeted, not very keen mentally, but amiable. They had bought a house on East 56th Street, and were looking for a new play with Lucas as co-star, when he unaccountably went to pieces nervously, stopped sleeping, and developed a slight twitching of his handsome, rather vacuous face. Judson Clark had taken his yacht and gone to Europe, and was reported from here and there not too favorably. But when he came back in early September, he had apparently recovered from his infatuation, was his old, carefully dressed self again, and when interviewed declared his intention of spending the winter on his Wyoming ranch. Of course he must have heard of Lucas's breakdown, and equally, of course, he must have seen them both. What happened at that interview, by what casual attitude he allayed Lucas's probable jealousy and the girl's own nervousness, Bassett had no way of discovering. It was clear that he convinced them both of his good faith, for the next note in the reporter's book was simply a date, September 12, 1911. That was the day they had all started west together, traveling in Clark's private car, with Lucas twitching slightly, smiling and waving farewell from a window. The big smash did not come until the middle of October. Bassett sat back and considered. He had a fairly clear idea of the conditions at the ranch, daily riding, some little reading, and a great deal too much of each other. A sick man, too, unhappy in his exile, chafing against his restrictions, lonely and irritable. The girl, early seeing her mistake, and Clark's jealousy of her husband. The door into their apartment closing, the thousand and one unconscious intimacies between man and wife, the breakfast for two going up the stairs, and below that hot-eyed boy, agonized and passionately jealous, yet meeting them and looking after them, their host and a gentleman. Lucas took to drinking after a time to allay his sheer boredom, and Jud Clark drank with him. At the end of 3 weeks they were both drinking heavily and were politely quarrelsome. Bassett could fill that in also. He could see the girl protesting, watching, increasingly anxious, as she saw that Clark's jealousy was matched by her husband's. A queer picture, he reflected, the three of them shut away on the great ranch, and every day some new tension, some new strain. Then, one night at dinner, they quarreled, and Beverly left the table. She was going to pack her things and go back to New York. She had felt, probably, that something was bound to snap. And while she was upstairs, Clark had shot and killed Howard Lucas, and himself disappeared. He had run, testament at the inquest revealed, to the corral and saddled a horse. Although it was only October, it was snowing hard, but in spite of that he had turned his horse toward the mountains. By midnight, a posse from Narada had started out, and another up the Dry River Canyon, but the storm turned into a blizzard in the mountains, and they were obliged to turn back. A few inches more snow, and they could not have got their horses out. A week or so later, with a crust of ice over it, a few of them began again, with no expectation, however, of finding Clark alive. They came across his horse on the second day, but they did not find him, and there were some among them who felt that, after all, old Elihu Clark's boy had chosen the better way. Bassett closed his notebook and lighted a cigar. There was a big story to be had for the seeking, a whale of a story. He could go to the office, give them a hint, draw expense money, and start for Narada the next night. He knew well enough that he would have to begin there, and that it would not be easy. Witnesses of the affair at the ranch would be missing now, or when found, the first accuracy of their statements would either be dulled by time or have been added to with the passing years. The ranch itself might have passed into other hands. To reconstruct the events of 10 years ago might be impossible, or nearly so. But that was not his problem. He would have to connect Narada with Haverly, Clark with Livingston. One thing only was simple. If he found Livingston's story was correct, that he had lived on a ranch near Narada before the crime, and as Livingston, then he would acknowledge that two men could look precisely alike and come from the same place, and yet not be the same. If not... But after he had turned out his light and got into bed, he began to feel a certain distaste for his self-appointed task. If Livingston were Clark, if after years of effort he had pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, had made himself a man out of the reckless boy he had been, a decent and useful citizen, why pull him down? After all, the world hadn't lost much in Lucas, a sleek, not over-intelligent big animal. That had been Howard Lucas. He decided to sleep over it, and by morning he found himself not only disinclined to the business, but firmly resolved to let it drop. Things were well enough as they were. The woman in the case was making good, Judd was making good, and nothing would restore Howard Lucas to that small theatrical world of his which had waved him good-bye at the station so long ago. He shaved and dressed, his resolution still holding. He had, indeed, almost a conscious glow of virtue, for he was making one of those inglorious and unsung sacrifices which ought to bring a man credit in the next world, because they certainly got him nowhere in this. He was quite affable to the colored waiter who served his breakfasts in the bachelor apartment house, and increased his weekly tip to $1.50. Then he sat down and opened the Times Republican, skimming over it after his habit for his own space, and frowning over a row of exclamation and interrogation points unwittingly set behind the name of the mayor. On the second page, however, he stopped, coffee cup in air. Is Judson Clark alive? Wife of former ranch manager makes confession. A woman named Margaret Donaldson, it appeared, fatally injured by an automobile near the town of Narada, Wyoming, had made a confession on her deathbed. In it she stated that, afraid to die without shriving her soul, she had sent for the sheriff of Dallas County and had made the following confession. That following the tragedy at the Clark Ranch, her husband, John Donaldson, since dead, had immediately, following the inquest where he testified, started out into the mountains in the hope of finding Clark alive, as he knew of a deserted ranger's cabin where Clark sometimes camped when hunting. It was his intention to search for Clark at this cabin and effect his escape. He carried with him food and brandy. That, owing to the blizzard, he was very nearly frozen. That he was obliged to abandon his horse, shooting it before he did so. And that close to death himself he finally reached the cabin and there found Judson Clark, the fugitive, who was very ill. She further testified that her husband cared for Clark for 4 days, Clark being delirious at the time, and that on the fifth day he started back on foot for the Clark Ranch, having left Clark locked in the cabin, and that on the following night he took 3 horses, 2 saddled and 1 packed with food and supplies, that accompanied by herself they went back to the cabin in the mountains, and that she remained there to care for Clark while her husband returned to the ranch to prevent suspicion. That a day or so later, looking out of her window, she had perceived a man outside in the snow coming toward the cabin, and that she had thought it one of the searching party. That her first instinct had been to lock him outside, but that she had finally admitted him, and that thereafter he had remained and had helped her to care for the sick man. Unfortunately for the rest of the narrative, it appeared that the injured woman had here lapsed into a coma and had subsequently died, carrying her further knowledge with her. But, the article went on, the story opened a field of infinite surmise. In all probability, Judson Clark was still alive, living under some assumed identity, free of punishment, outwardly respectable. 3 years before, he had been adjudged legally dead, and the estate divided under bond of the legatees. Close to $100 million had gone to charities, and Judson Clark, wherever he was, would be dependent on his own efforts for existence. He could have summoned all the legal talent in the country to his defense, but instead he had chosen to disappear. The whole situation turned on the deposition of Mrs. Donaldson, now dead. The local authorities at Narada maintained that the woman had not been sane for several years. On the other hand, the cabin to which she referred was well known, and no search of it had been made at the time. Clark's horse had been found not 10 miles from the town, and the cabin was buried in snow 20 miles further away. If Clark had made that journey on foot, he had accomplished the impossible. Certain facts, according to the local correspondent, bore out Margaret Donaldson's confession. Inquiry showed that she was supposed to have spent the winter following Judson Clark's crime with relatives in Omaha. She had returned to the ranch the following spring. A detailed description of Judson Clark and a photograph of him accompanied the story. Bassett reread the article carefully and swore a little under his breath. If he had needed confirmation of his suspicions, it lay to his hand. But the situation had changed overnight. There would be a search for Clark now, as wide as the knowledge of his disappearance. Local police authorities would turn him up in every city from Maine to the Pacific coast. Even Europe would be on the lookout, and South America. But it was not the police he feared so much as the press. Not all of the papers, but some of them, would go after that story and send their best men on it. It offered not so much a chance of solution as an opportunity to revive the old dramatic story. He could see, when he closed his eyes, the local photographers climbing to that cabin and later sending its pictures broadcast, and divers gentlemen of the press, eager to pit their wits against 10 years of time and the ability of a once conspicuous man to hide from the law, packing their suitcases for Nevada. No, he couldn't stop now. He would go on like the others, and with this advantage, that he was morally certain he could lay his hands on Clark at any time. But he would have to prove his case, connected. Who, for instance, was the other man in the cabin? He must have known who the boy was who lay in that rough bunk delirious. Must have suspected, anyhow. That made him, like the Donaldsons, accessory after the fact, and criminally liable. Small chance of him coming out with any confession. Yet he was the connecting link. Must be. On his third reading, the reporter began to visualize the human elements of the fight to save the boy. He saw moving before him the whole pitiful struggle, the indomitable ranch manager, his heartbreaking struggle with the blizzard, the shooting of his horse, the careful disarming of suspicion, and later the intrepid woman, daring that night ride through snow that had sent the posse back to its firesides, to the boy, locked in the cabin and raving. His mind was busy as he packed his suitcase. Already he had forgotten his compunctions of the early morning. He moved about methodically, calculating roughly what expense money he would need and the line of attack, if any, required at the office. Between Nevada and that old brick house at Haverly lay his story. 10 years of it. He was closing his bag when he remembered the little girl in the blue dress at the theater. He straightened and scowled. After a moment he snapped the bag shut. Damn it all, if Clark had chosen to tie up with the girl, that was on Clark's conscience, not his. But he was vaguely uncomfortable. "It's a queer world, Joe," he observed to the waiter, who had come in for the breakfast dishes. "Yes, sir, it is that," said Joe. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. During all the long night, Dick sat by David's bedside. Earlier in the evening there had been a consultation. David had suffered a light stroke, but there was no paralysis, and the prognosis was good. For this time, at least, David had escaped. But there must be no other time. He was to be kept quiet and free from worry. His diet was to be carefully regulated, and with care he still had long years before him. David slept, his breathing heavy and slow. In the morning there would be a nurse, but that night Dick, having sent Lucy to bed, himself kept watch. On the walnut bed lay Dr. David's portly figure, dimly outlined by the shaded lamp, and on a chair drawn close sat Dick. He was wide awake and very anxious, but as time went on and no untoward symptoms appeared, as David's sleep seemed to grow easier and more natural, Dick's thoughts wandered. They went to Elizabeth first, and then on and on from that starting point, through the years ahead. He saw the old house with Elizabeth waiting in it for his return. He saw both their lives united and flowing on together, with children, with small cares, with the routine of daily living, and behind it all the two of them, hand in hand. Then his mind turned on himself. How often in the past 10 years it had done that. He had sat off with a sort of professional detachment and studied his own case. With the entrance into his world of the new science of psychoanalysis, he had made now and then small, not very sincere, attempts to penetrate the veil of his own unconscious devising. Not very sincere, for with the increase of his own knowledge of the mind, he had learned that behind such conditions as his lay generally, deeply hidden, the desire to forget,
and that behind that there lay, acknowledged or not, fear. But to forget what, he used to say to David, when the first textbooks on the new science appeared, and he and David were learning the new terminology, Dick eagerly, and David with contemptuous snorts of derision, to forget what? "You had plenty to forget," David would say stolidly. "I think this man's a fool, but at that, you'd had your father's death, for one thing, and you'd gone pretty close to the edge of eternity yourself. You'd fought single-handed the worst storm of 10 years, you came out of it with double pneumonia, and you lay alone in that cabin about 56 hours. Forget? You had plenty to forget." It had never occurred to Dick to doubt David's story. It did not, even now. He had accepted it unquestioningly from the first, supplemented the shadowy, childish memories that remained to him with it, and gradually coordinating, the two had built out of them his house of the past. Thus the elderly man whom he dimly remembered was not only his father, he was David's brother. And he had died. It was the shock of that death, according to David, that had sent him into the mountains, where David had followed and nursed him back to health. It was quite simple, and even explicable by the new psychology. Not that he had worried about the new psychology in those early days. He had been profoundly lethargic, passive and incurious. It had been too much trouble even to think. True, he had brought over from those lost years certain instincts and a few mental pictures. He had had a certain impatience at first over the restrictions of comparative poverty. He had had to learn the value of money. And the pictures he retained had had a certain opulence which the facts appeared to contradict. Thus he remembered a large ranch house and innumerable horses grazing in meadows or milling in a corral. But David had warned him early that there was no estate, that his future depended entirely on his own efforts. Then the new life had caught and held him. For the first time he had mothering and love. Lucy was his mother, and David the pattern to which he meant to conform. He was happy and contented. Now and then in the early days he had been conscious of a desire to go back and try to reconstruct his past again. Later on he knew that if he were ever to fill up the gap in his life, it would be easier in that environment of once familiar things. But in the first days he had been totally dependent on David, and money was none too plentiful. Later on, as the new life took hold, as he went to medical college and worked at odd clerical jobs and vacations to help pay his way, there had been no chance. Then the war came, and on his return there had been the practice and his knowledge that David's health was not what it should have been. But as time went on, he was more and more aware that there was in him a peculiar shrinking from going back, an almost apprehension. He knew more of the mind than he had before, and he knew that not physical hardship but mental stress caused such lapses as his. But what mental stress had been great enough for such a smash? His father's death? Strain and fear, said the new psychology. Fear? He had never found himself lacking in courage. Certainly he would have fought a man who called him a coward. But there was cowardice behind all such conditions as his. A refusal of the mind to face reality. It was weak, weak. He hated himself for that past failure of his to face reality. But that night, sitting by David's bed, he faced reality with a vengeance. He was in love, and he wanted the things that love should bring to a normal man. He felt normal. He felt, strengthened by love, that he could face whatever life had to bring, so long as it also brought Elizabeth. Painfully he went back over his talk with David the preceding Sunday night. "Don't be a fool," David had said. "Go ahead and take her if she'll have you. And don't be too long about it. I'm not as young as I used to be." "What I feel," he had replied, "is this. I don't know, of course, if she cares." David had grunted. "I do know. I'm going to try to make her care. If it's humanly possible. But I'd like to go back to the ranch again, David, before things go any further." "Why?" "I'd like to fill the gap. Attempt it, anyhow." What he was thinking about as he sat by David's bedside was David's attitude toward that threatened return of his. For David had opposed it, offering a dozen trivial, almost puerile reasons.
had shown indeed a dogged obstinacy and an irritability that was somehow oddly like fear. David afraid? David, whose life and heart were open books? David, whose eyes never wavered, nor his courage? "You let well enough alone, Dick," he had finished. "You've got everything you want, and a medical man can't afford to go gadding about. When people want him, they want him." But he had noticed that David had been different since. He had taken to following him with his faded old eyes, had even spoken once of retiring and turning all the work over to him. Was it possible that David did not want him to go back to Norada? He bent over and felt the sick man's pulse. It was stronger, not so rapid. The mechanical act took him back to his first memory of David. He had been lying in a rough bunk in the mountain cabin, and David, beside him on a wooden box, had been bending forward and feeling his pulse. He had felt weak and utterly inert, and he knew now that he had been very ill. The cabin had been a small and lonely one, with snow peaks not far above it, and it had been very cold. During the day, a woman kept up the fire. Her name was Maggie, and she moved about the cabin like a thin ghost. At night she slept in a lean-to shed, and David kept the fire going. A man who seemed to know him well, John Donaldson, he learned was his name, was Maggie's husband, and every so often he came, about dawn, and brought food and supplies. After a long time, as he grew stronger, Maggie had gone away, and David had fried the bacon and heated the canned tomatoes or the beans. Before she left, she had written out a recipe for biscuits, and David would study over it painstakingly and then produce a panful of burned and blackened lumps over which he would groan and agonize. He himself had been totally incurious. He had lived a sort of animal life of food and sleep, and later on of small tentative excursions around the room on legs that shook when he walked. The snows came and almost covered the cabin, and David had read a great deal and talked at intervals. David had tried to fill up the gap in his mind. That was how he learned that David was his father's brother, and that his father had recently died. Going over it all now, it had certain elements that were not clear. They had, for instance, never gone back to the ranch at all. With the first clearing of the snow in the spring, John Donaldson had appeared again leading two saddled horses and driving a pack animal, and they had started off, leaving him standing in the clearing and gazing after them. But they had not followed Donaldson's trail. They had started west, over the mountains, and David did not know the country. Once they were lost for 3 days. He looked at the figure on the bed. Only 10 years, and yet at that time David had been vigorous, seemed almost young. He had aged in that 10 years. On the bed he was an old man, a tired old man at that. On that long ride he had been tireless. He had taken the burden of the nightly camps and had hacked a trail with his hatchet across snowfields, while Dick, still weak but furiously protesting, had been compelled to stand and watch. Now, with the perspective of time behind him, and with the clearly defined issue of David's protest against his return to the West, he went again over the details of that winter and spring. Why had they not taken Donaldson's trail, or gone back to the ranch? Why, since Donaldson could make it, had not other visitors come? Another doctor, the night he almost died, and David sat under the lamp behind the close-screened windows and read the very pocket prayer book that now lay on the stand beside the bed? Why had they burned his clothes and Donaldson brought a new outfit? Why did Donaldson, for all his requests, never bring a razor, so that when they struck the railroad miles from anywhere, they were both fully bearded? He brought himself up sharply. He had allowed his imagination to run away with him. He had been depicting a flight, and no one who knew David could imagine him in flight. Nevertheless, he was conscious of a new uneasiness and anxiety. When David recovered sufficiently, he would go to Norada, as he told Elizabeth, and there he would find the Donaldsons and clear up the things that bothered him. After that, he thought of Elizabeth, of her sweetness and sanity. He remembered her at the theater the evening before, lost in its fictitious emotions, its counterfeit drama. He had felt moved to comfort her when he found her on the verge of tears. "Just remember, they're only acting," he had said.
"Yes, but life does do things like that to people."
"Not often. The theatre deals in the dramatic exceptions to life. You and I, plain bread-and-butter people, come to see these things because we get a sort of vicarious thrill out of them."
"Doesn't anything ever happen to the plain bread-and-butter people?"
"A little jam sometimes, or perhaps they drop it, butter side down, on the carpet."
"But that is tragedy, isn't it?" He had had to acknowledge that it might be, but he had been quite emphatic over the fact that most people didn't drop it. After a long time he slept in his chair. The spring wind came in through the opened window and fluttered the leaves of the old prayer book on the stand. End of chapter 12.
Chapter 13 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Rinehart. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The week that followed was an anxious one. David's physical condition slowly improved. The slight thickness was gone from his speech, and he sipped resignedly at the broths Lucy or the nurse brought at regular intervals. Over the entire house there hung all day the odor of stewing chicken or of beef tea in the making, and above the doorbell was a white card which said, "Don't ring, walk in." As it happened, no one in the old house had seen Maggie Donaldson's confession in the newspaper. Lucy was saved that anxiety at least. Appearing as it did the morning after David's stroke, it came in with the morning milk, lay about unnoticed, and passed out again to start a fire or line a pantry shelf. Harrison Miller, next door, read it over his coffee. Walter Wheeler, in the 8:30 train, glanced at it and glanced away. Nina Ward read it in bed, and that was all. There came to the house a steady procession of inquirers and bearers of small tribute, flowers and jellies mostly, but other things also. A table in David's room held a steadily growing number of bedroom slippers, and Mrs. Morgan had been seen buying soles for still others. David, propped up in his bed, would cheer a little at these votive offerings, and then relapse again into the heavy, troubled silence that worried Dick and frightened Lucy Crosby. Something had happened, she was sure, something connected with Dick. She watched David when Dick was in the room, and she saw that his eyes followed the younger man with something very like terror. And for the first time since he had walked into the house that night so long ago, followed by the tall young man for whose coming a letter had prepared her, she felt that David had withdrawn himself from her. She went about her daily tasks a little hurt, and waited for him to choose his own time. But as the days went on, she saw that whatever this new thing might be, he meant to fight it out alone, and that the fighting it out alone was bad for him. He improved very slowly. She wondered sometimes if it was after all because of Dick's growing interest in Elizabeth Wheeler. She knew that he was seeing her daily, although he was too busy now for more than a hasty call. She felt that she could even tell when he had seen her. He would come in, glowing and almost exalted, and as if to make up for the moment stolen from David, would leap up the stairs two at a time and burst into the invalid's room like a cheerful cyclone. Wasn't it possible that David had begun to feel as she did, that the girl was entitled to a clean slate before she pledged herself to Dick? And the slate, poor Dick, could never be cleaned. Then one day David astonished them both. He was propped up in his bed, and he had demanded a cigar, and had been very gently but firmly refused. He had been rather sulky about it, and Dick had been attempting to rally him into a better humor when he said suddenly, "I've had time to think things over, Dick. I haven't been fair to you. You're thrown away here. Besides," he hesitated, "then we might as well face it. The day of the general practitioner has gone." "I don't believe it," Dick said stoutly. "Maybe we are only signposts to point the way to the other fellows, but the world will always need signposts." "What I've been thinking of," David pursued his own train of thought, "is this. I want you to go to Johns Hopkins and take up the special work you've been wanting to do. I'll be up soon and—"
"Call the nurse, Aunt Lucy," said Dick. "He's raving."
"Not at all," David retorted testily. "I've told you. This whole town only comes here now to be told what specialist to go to, and you know it."
I don't know anything of the sort." "If you don't, it's because you won't face the facts." Dick chuckled and threw an arm over David's shoulder. "You old hypocrite," he said. "You're trying to get rid of me for some reason. Don't tell me you're going to get married." But David did not smile. Lucy, watching him from her post by the window, saw his face and felt a spasm of fear. At the most, she had feared a mental conflict in David. Now she saw that it might be something infinitely worse, something impending and immediate. She could hardly reply when Dick appealed to her. "Are you going to let him get rid of me like this, Aunt Lucy?" he demanded. "Sentenced to Johns Hopkins like Napoleon to St. Helena? Are you with me or for ninst me?" "I don't know, Dick," she said, with her eyes on David. "If it's for your good..." She went out after a time, leaving them at it hammer and tongs. David was vanquished in the end, but Dick, going down to the office later on, was puzzled. Somehow it was borne in on him that behind David's insistence was a reason, unspoken but urgent, and the only reason that occurred to him as possible was that David did not, after all, want him to marry Elizabeth Wheeler. He put the matter to the test that night, wandering in dressing gown and slippers, as was his custom before going to bed for a brief chat. The nurse was downstairs, and Dick moved about the room restlessly. Then he stopped and stood by the bed, looking down. "A few nights ago, David, I asked you if you thought it would be right for me to marry, if my situation justified it, and if to your knowledge there was any other reason why I could not or should not. You said there was not." "There is no reason, of course, if she'll have you." "I don't know that. I know that whether she will or not is a pretty vital matter to me, David." David nodded silently. "But now you want me to go away, to leave her. You're rather urgent about it. And I feel, well, I begin to think that you have a reason for it." David clenched his hands under the bedclothing, but he returned Dick's gaze steadily. "She's a good girl," he said, "but she's entitled to more than you can give her the way things are." "That is, presupposing that she cares for me. I haven't an idea that she does. That she may in time. Then, that's the reason for this Johns Hopkins thing, is it?" "That's the reason," David said stoutly. "She would wait for you. She's that sort. I've known her all her life. She's as steady as a rock. But she's been brought up to have a lot of things. Walter Wheeler is well off. You do as I want you to. Pack your things and go to Baltimore. Bring Reynolds down here to look after the work till I'm around again." But Dick evaded the direct issue thus opened and followed another line of thought. "Of course you understand," he observed, after a renewal of his restless pacing, "that I've got to tell her my situation first. I don't need to tell you that I funk doing it, but it's got to be done." "Don't be a fool," David said querulously. "You'll set a lot of women cackling, and what they don't know they'll invent. I know 'em." "Only herself and her family." "Why?" "Because they have a right to know it." But when he saw David formulating a further protest, he dropped the subject. "I'll not do it until we've got into it together," he promised. "There's plenty of time. You settle down now and get ready for sleep." When the nurse came in at 11 o'clock, she found Dick gone and David very still with his face to the wall. It was the end of May before David began to move about his upper room. The trees along the shaded streets had burst into full leaf by that time, and Mike was enjoying that gardener's interval of paradise when flowers grow faster than the weeds among them. Harrison Miller, having rolled his lawn through all of April, was heard abroad in the early mornings with the lawn mower, or hoe in hand was to be seen behind his house in his vegetable patch. Cars rolled through the streets, the rear seats laden with blossoming loot from the country lanes, and the Wheeler dog was again burying bones in the soft, warm ground under the hedge. Elizabeth Wheeler was very happy. Her look of expectant waiting, once vague, had crystallized now into definite form. She was waiting, timidly and shyly, but with infinite content. In time, everything would come. And in the meantime there was today, and sometime today a shabby car would stop at the door, and there would be 5 minutes or 10, and then Dick would have to hurry to work or back to David. After that, of course, today was over,
but there would always be tomorrow. Now and then at choir practice or at service she saw Clare Rossiter, but Clare was very cool to her, and never on any account sought her or spoke to her alone. She was rather unhappy about Clare when she remembered her, because it must be so terrible to care for a man who only said, when one spoke of Clare, "Oh, the tall blonde girl." Once or twice, too, she had found Clare's eyes on her, and they were hostile eyes. It was almost as though they said, "I hate you because you know, but don't dare to pity me." Yet somehow Elizabeth found herself not entirely believing that Clare's passion was real, because the real thing you hid with all your might, at least until you were sure it was wanted. After that, of course, you could be so proud of it that you might become utterly shameless. She was afraid sometimes that she was the sort to be utterly shameless. Yet for all her halcyon hours, there were little things that worried her. Wally Sayre, for instance, was always having to be kept from saying things she didn't want to hear. And Nina. She wasn't sure that Nina was entirely happy. And, of course, there was Jim. Jim was difficult. Sometimes he was a man, and then again he was a boy, and one never knew just which he was going to be. He was too old for discipline, and too young to manage himself. He was spending almost all his evenings away from home now, and her mother always drew an inaudible sigh when he was spoken of. Elizabeth had waited up for him one night, only a short time before, and beckoning him into her room, had talked to him severely. "You ought to be ashamed, Jim," she said. "You're simply worrying Mother sick." "Well, why?" he demanded defiantly. "I'm old enough to take care of myself." "You ought to be taking care of her, too." He had looked rather crestfallen at that, and before he went out he offered a half-sheepish explanation. "I'd tell them where I go," he said, "but you'd think a pool-room was on the direct road to hell. Take tonight now. I can't tell them about it, but it was all right. I met Wally Sayre and Leslie at the club before dinner, and we got a fourth and played bridge. Only half a cent a point. I swear we were going on playing, but somebody brought in a chap named Gregory for a cocktail. He turned out to be a brother of Beverly Carlyle, the actress, and he took us around to the theater and gave us a box. Not a thing wrong with it, was there?" "Where did you go from there?" she persisted inexorably. "It's 1:30. "Went around and met her. She's wonderful, Elizabeth. But do you know what would happen if I told them? They'd have a fit." She felt rather helpless, because she knew he was right from his own standpoint. "I know. I'm surprised at Les, Jim." "Oh, Les. He just trailed along. He's all right." She kissed him, and he went out, leaving her to lie awake for a long time. She would have had all her world happy those days, and all her world good. She didn't want anybody's bread and butter spilled on the carpet. So the days went on, and the web slowly wove itself into its complicated pattern. Bassett speeding west, and David in his quiet room, Jim and Leslie Ward seeking amusement and finding it in the littered dressing room of a woman star at a local theater, Clare Rossiter brooding, and the little question being whispered behind hands, figuratively, of course. The village was entirely well-bred. Gregory calling round to see Bassett, and turning away with the information that he had gone away for an indefinite time, and Maggie Donaldson lying in the cemetery at the foot of the mountains outside Norada, having shriven her soul to the limit of her strength so that she might face her Maker. Out of all of them, it was Clare Rossiter who made the first conscious move of the shuttle. Clare, affronted and not a little malicious, but perhaps still dramatizing herself, this time, as the friend who feels forced to carry bad tidings. Behind even that, however, was an unconscious desire to see Dick again, and this time so to impress herself on him that never again could he pass her in the street unnoticed. On the day, then, that David first sat up in bed, Clare went to the house and took her place in the waiting room. She was dressed with extreme care, and she carried a parasol. With it, while she waited, she drilled small nervous indentations into the old office carpet and formulated her line of action. Nevertheless, she found it hard to begin. "I don't want to keep you if you're busy," she said, avoiding his eyes. "If you are in a hurry..." "This is my business," he said patiently, and waited. "I wonder if you are going to understand me when I do begin?"
"You sound alarmingly ominous." He smiled at her, and she had a moment of panic. "You don't look like a young lady with anything eating at her damask cheek, or however it goes."
"Dr. Livingstone," she said suddenly, "people are saying something about you that you ought to know."
He stared at her, amazed and incredulous.
"About me? What can they say? That's absurd."
"I felt you ought to know. Of course I don't believe it, not for a moment. But you know what this town is."
"I know it's a very good town," he said steadily. "However, let's have it. I dare say it's not very serious."
She was uneasy enough by that time, and rather frightened when she had finished. For he sat, quiet and rather pale, not looking at her at all, but gazing fixedly at an old daguerreotype of David that stood on his desk. One that Lucy had shown him one day, and which he had preempted. David, at the age of 8, in a small black velvet suit, and with very thin legs.
"I thought you ought to know," she justified herself nervously.
Dick got up.
"Yes," he said, "I ought to know, of course. Thank you."
When she had gone, he went back and stood before the picture again. From Claire's first words, he had had a stricken conviction that the thing was true, that as Mrs. Cook Morgan's visitor from Wyoming had insisted, Henry Livingstone had never married, never had a son. He stood and gazed at the picture. His world had collapsed about him, but he was steady and very erect.
"David, David," he thought, "why did you do it? And what am I? And who?"
Characteristically, his first thought after that was of David himself. Whatever David had done, his motive had been right. He would have to start with that. If David had built for him a false identity, it was because there was a necessity for it. Something shameful, something he was to be taken away from. Wasn't it probable that David had heard the gossip and had then collapsed? Wasn't the fear that he himself would hear it behind David's insistence that he go to Baltimore? His thoughts flew to Elizabeth. Everything was changed now, as to Elizabeth. He would have to be very certain of that past of his before he could tell her that he loved her, and he had a sense of immediate helplessness. He could not go to David as things were. To Lucy? Probably he would have gone to Lucy at once, but the telephone rang. He answered it, got his hat and bag, and went out to the car. Years with David had made automatic the subordination of self to the demands of the practice. At 6:30, Lucy heard him come in and go into his office. When he did not immediately reappear and take his flying run up the stairs to David's room, she stood outside the office door and listened. She had a premonition of something wrong, something of the truth, perhaps. Anyhow, she tapped at the door and opened it, to find him sitting very quietly at his desk, with his head in his hands. "Dick," she exclaimed, "is anything wrong?"
"I have a headache," he said. He looked at his watch and got up. "I'll take a look at David, and then we'll have dinner. I didn't know it was so late."
But when she had gone out, he did not immediately move. He had been going over again, painfully and carefully, the things that puzzled him, that he had accepted before without dispute. David and Lucy's reluctance to discuss his father. The long days in the cabin, with David helping him to reconstruct his past. The spring and that slow progress which now, he felt, somehow had been an escape. He ate very little dinner, and Lucy's sense of dread increased. When, after the meal, she took refuge in her sitting room on the lower floor and picked up her knitting, it was with a conviction that it was only a temporary reprieve. She did not know from what. She heard him, some time later, coming down from David's room. But he did not turn into his office. Instead, he came onto her door, stood for a moment like a man undecided, then came in. She did not look up, even when very gently he took her knitting from her and laid it on the table. "Aunt Lucy."
"Yes, Dick."
"Don't you think we'd better have a talk?"
"What about?" she asked, with her heart hammering.
"About me." He stood above her and looked down, still with the tenderness with which he always regarded her, but with resolution in his very attitude. "First of all, I'll tell you something. Then I'll ask you to tell me all you can."
She yearned over him as he told her, for all her terror. His voice, for all its steadiness, was strained. "I have felt for some time," he finished, "that you and David were keeping something from me. I think now that this is what it was. Of course, you realize that I shall have to know."
"Dick, Dick," was all she could say.
"I was about," he went on, with his almost terrible steadiness, "to ask a girl to take my name. I want to know if I have a name to offer her. I have, you see, only two alternatives to believe about myself. Either I am Henry Livingstone's illegitimate son, and in that case I have no right to my name or to offer it to anyone, or I am," he made a despairing gesture, "or I am someone else, someone who was smuggled out of the mountains and given an identity that makes him a living lie." Always she had known that this might come sometime, but always, too, she had seen David bearing the brunt of it. He should bear it. It was not of her doing or of her approving. For years the danger of discovery had hung over her head like a cloud. "Do you know which?" he persisted.
"Yes, Dick."
"Would you have the unbelievable cruelty not to tell me?" She got up, a taut little figure with a dignity born of her fear and of her love for him. "I shall not betray David's confidence," she said. "Long ago I warned him that this time would come. I was never in favor of keeping you in ignorance, but it is David's problem, and I cannot take the responsibility of telling you." He knew her determination and her obstinate loyalty, but he was fairly desperate. "You know that if you don't tell me, I shall go to David?"
"If you go now, you will kill him."
"It's as bad as that, is it?" he asked grimly. "Then there is something shameful behind it, is there?"
"No, no, Dick, not that. And I want you always to remember this. What David did was out of love for you. He has made many sacrifices for you. First he saved your life, and then he made you what you are, and he has a great pride in it. Don't destroy his work of years."
Her voice broke, and she turned to go out, her chin quivering, but halfway to the door he called to her.
"Aunt Lucy," he said gently.
She heard him behind her, felt his strong arms as he turned her about. He drew her to him and, stooping, kissed her cheek. "You're right," he said, "always right. I'll not worry him with it. My word of honor. When the time comes he'll tell me, and until it comes I'll wait. And I love you both. Don't ever forget that." He kissed her again and let her go. But long after David had put down his prayer book that night, and after the nurse had rustled down the stairs to the night supper on the dining-room table, Lucy lay awake and listened to Dick's slow pacing of his bedroom floor. He was very gentle with David from that time on, and tried to return to his old light-hearted ways. On the day David was to have his first broiled sweetbread, he caught the nurse outside, borrowed her cap and apron, and carried in the tray himself.
"I hope your food is to your taste, Dr. David," he said in a high falsetto which set the nurse giggling in the hall. "I may not be much of a nurse, but I can cook."
Even Lucy was deceived at times. He went his customary round, sent out the monthly bill, opened and answered David's mail, bore the double burden of David's work and his own ungrudgingly, but off guard he was grave and abstracted. He began to look very thin, too, and Lucy often heard him pacing the floor at night. She thought that he seldom or never went to the Wheelers. And so passed the tenth day of David's illness, with the smile on Elizabeth's face growing a trifle fixed as 3 days went by without the shabby car rattling to the door, with the valley playing its second and final week before going into New York, and with Leslie Ward unconsciously taking up the shuttle Clare had dropped and carrying the pattern 1 degree further toward completion. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Just how Leslie Ward had drifted into his innocuous affair with the Star of the Valley, he was not certain himself. Innocuous it certainly was. Afterwards, looking back, he was to wonder sometimes if it had not been precisely for the purpose it served. But that was long months after. not until the pattern was completed and he was able to recognize his own work in it. The truth was that he was not too happy at home. Nina's smart little house on the Ridgely Road had at first kept her busy. She had spent unlimited time with decorators, had studied and rejected innumerable watercolor sketches of interiors, had haunted auction rooms and bid recklessly on things she felt at the moment she could not do without, later on to have to wheedle Leslie into straightening her bank balance. Thought, too, and considerable energy had gone into training and outfitting her servants, and still more into inducing them to wear the expensive uniforms and livery she provided. But what she made so successfully was a house rather than a home. There were times, indeed, when Leslie began to feel that it was not even a house, but a small hotel. They almost never dined alone, and when they did, Nina would explain that everybody was tied up. Then, after dinner, restlessness would seize her, and she would want to run into the theater or to make a call. If he refused, she nursed a grievance all evening. And he did not like her friends. Things came to a point where, when he knew one of the gay evenings was on, he would stay in town playing billiards at his club, or occasionally wandering into a theater where he stood or sat at the back of the house and watched the play with cynical, discontented eyes. The casual meeting with Gregory and the introduction to his sister brought a new interest. Perhaps the very novelty was what first attracted him, the oddity of feeling that he was on terms of friendship, for it amounted to that, with surprising quickness, with a famous woman whose face smiled out at him from his morning paper, or huge and shockingly colored from the sheets on the billboards. He formed the habit of calling on her in the afternoons at her hotel, and he saw that she liked it. It was often lonely, she explained. He sent her flowers and cigarettes, and he found her poised and restful, and sometimes, when she was off guard, with the lines of old suffering on her face. She sat still. She didn't fidget as Nina did. She listened, too. She was not as beautiful as she appeared on the stage, but she was attractive, and he stilled his conscience with the knowledge that she placed no undue emphasis on his visits. In her world, men came and went, brought or sent small tribute, and she was pleased and grateful. No more. The next week or the week after, and other men in other places would be doing the same things. But he wondered about her. Did she ever think of Judson Clark and the wreck he had made of her life? What of resentment and sorrow lay behind her quiet face, or the voice with its careful intonations, which was so unlike Nina's? Now and then he saw her brother. He neither liked nor disliked Gregory, but he suspected him of rather bullying Beverly. On the rare occasions when he saw them together, there was a sort of nervous tension in the air, and although Leslie was not subtle, he sensed some hidden difference between them. A small incident one day almost brought this concealed dissension to a head. He said to Gregory, "By the way, I saw you in Haverly yesterday afternoon." "Must have seen somebody else. Haverly? Where's Haverly?" Leslie Ward had been rather annoyed. There had been no mistake about the recognition. But he passed it off with that curious sense of sex loyalty that will actuate a man even toward his enemies. "Funny," he said. "Chap looked like you, maybe a little heavier." Nevertheless, he had a conviction that he had said something better left unsaid, and that Beverly Carlyle's glance at her brother was almost hostile. He had that instantaneous picture of the two of them, the man defiant and somehow frightened, and the woman's eyes anxious and yet slightly contemptuous. Then, in a flash, it was gone. He had meant to go home that evening, would have probably, for he was not ignorant of where he was drifting. But when he went back to the office, Nina was on the wire, with the news that they were to go with a party to a country inn. "For chicken and waffles, Les," she said. "It will be oceans of fun, and I've promised the cocktails." "I'm tired," he replied sulkily. "And why don't you let some of the other fellows come over with the drinks? It seems to me I'm always the goat." "Oh, if that's the way you feel," Nina said, and hung up the receiver. He did not go home. He went to the theater and stood at the back with his sense of guilt deadened by the knowledge that Nina was having what she would call a heavenly time. After all, it would soon be over. He counted the days. The valley had only four more before it moved on. He had already played his small part in the drama that involved Dick Livingstone, but he was unaware of it. He went home that night to find Nina settled in bed and very sulky, and he retired himself in no pleasant frame of mind, but he took a firmer hold of himself that night before he slept. He didn't want to smash, and yet they might be headed that way. He wouldn't see Beverly Carlysle again. He lived up to his resolve the next day, bought his flowers as usual, but this time for Nina, and took them with him, and went home with the orchids, which were really an offering to his own conscience. But Nina was not at home. The butler reported that she was dining at the Wheelers', and he thought the man eyed him with restrained commiseration. "Did she say I am expected there?" he asked. "She ordered dinner for you here, sir." Even for Nina that sounded odd. He took his coat and went out again to the car. After a moment's hesitation, he went back and got the orchids. Dick Livingstone's machine was at the curb before the Wheeler house, and in the living room he found Walter Wheeler pacing the floor. Mr. Wheeler glanced at him and looked away. "Anybody sick?" Leslie asked, his feeling of apprehension growing. "Nina is having hysterics upstairs," Mr. Wheeler said, and continued his pacing. "Nina? Hysterics?" "That's what I said," replied Mr. Wheeler, suddenly savage. "You've made a nice mess of things, haven't you?" Leslie placed the box of orchids on the table and drew off his gloves. His mind was running over many possibilities. "You'd better tell me about it, hadn't you?" "Oh, I will. Don't worry. I've seen this coming for months. I'm not taking her part. God knows I know her, and she has as much idea of making a home as, he looked about, as that poker has. But that's the worst you can say of her. As to you..." "Well?" Mr. Wheeler's anxiety was greater than his anger. He lowered his voice. "She got a bill today for 2 or 3 boxes of flowers sent to some actress." And when Leslie said nothing, "I'm not condoning it, mind you. You'd no business to do it. But," he added fretfully, "why the devil, if you've got to act the fool, don't you have your bill sent to your office?" "I suppose I don't need to tell you that that's all there was to it? Flowers, I mean?" "I'm taking that for granted, but she says she won't go back." Leslie was aghast and frightened. Not at the threat. She would go back, of course. But she would always hold it against him. She cherished small grudges faithfully, and he knew she would never understand, never see her own contribution to his mild affection, nor comprehend the actual innocence of those afternoons of tea and talk. There was no sound from upstairs. Mr. Wheeler got his hat and went out, calling to the dog. Jim came in whistling, looked in and said, "Hello, Les," and disappeared. He sat in the growing twilight and cursed himself for a fool. After all, where had he been heading? A man couldn't eat his cake and have it. But he was resentful, too. He stressed rather hard his own innocence and chose to ignore the less innocent impulse that lay behind it. After an hour or so he heard someone descending, and Dick Livingstone appeared in the hall. He called to him, and Dick entered the room. Before he sat down he lighted a cigarette, and in the flare of the match Leslie got an impression of fatigue and of something new, of trouble. But his own anxieties obsessed him. "She's told you about it, I suppose?" "I was a fool, of course, but it was only a matter of a few flowers and some afternoon calls. She's a fine woman, Livingstone, and she is lonely. The women have given her a pretty cold deal since the Clark story. They copy her clothes and her walk, but they don't ask her into their homes." "Isn't the trouble more fundamental than that, Ward? I was thinking about it upstairs. Nina was pretty frank. She says you've had your good time and want to settle down, and that she is young and now is her only chance. Later on there may be children, you know. She blames herself, too, but she has a fairly clear idea of how it happened." "Do you think she'll go back home?" "She promised she would." They sat smoking in silence. In the dining room Annie was laying the table for dinner, and a most untragic odor of new garden peas began to steal along the hall. Dick suddenly stirred and threw away his cigarette. "I was going to talk to you about something else," he said, "but this is hardly the time. I'll get on home." He rose. "She'll be all right.
Only I'd advise very tactful handling and the fullest explanation you can make. What is it? I'd be glad to have something to keep my mind occupied. It's eating itself up just now. It's a personal matter. Ward glanced up at him quickly. Yes? Have you happened to hear a story that I believe is going around, one that concerns me? Well, I have, Leslie admitted. I didn't pay much attention. Nobody is taking it very seriously. That's not the point, Dick persisted. I don't mind idle gossip. I don't give a damn about it. It's the statement itself. I should say that you are the only person who knows anything about it. Dick made a restless, impatient gesture. I want to know one thing more, he said. Nina told you, I suppose. I suppose Elizabeth knows it, too? I rather think she does. Dick turned abruptly and went out of the room, and a moment later Leslie heard the front door slam. Elizabeth, standing at the head of the stairs, heard it also, and turned away with a new droop to her usually valiant shoulders. Her world, too, had gone awry, that safe world of protection and cheer and kindliness. First had come Nina, white-lipped and shaken, and Elizabeth had had to face the fact that there were such things as treachery and the queer hidden things that men did, and that came to light and brought horrible suffering. And that afternoon she had had to acknowledge that there was something wrong with Dick. No, between Dick and herself. There was a formality in his speech to her, an aloofness that seemed to ignore utterly their new intimacy. He was there, but he was miles away from her. She tried hard to feel indignant, but she was only hurt. Peace seemed definitely to have abandoned the Wheeler house. Then late in the evening a measure of it was restored when Nina and Leslie effected a reconciliation. It followed several bad hours when Nina had locked her door against them all, but at 10 o'clock she sent for Leslie and faced him with desperate calmness. To Elizabeth, putting cold cloths on her mother's head as she lay on the bed, there came a growing conviction that the relation between men and women was a complicated and baffling thing, and that love and hate were sometimes close together. Love and habit, perhaps, triumphed in Nina's case, however, for at 11 o'clock they heard Leslie going down the stairs, and later on moving about the kitchen and pantry while whistling softly. The servants had gone, and the air was filled with the odor of burning bread. Sometime later, Mrs. Wheeler, waiting uneasily in the upper hall, beheld her son-in-law coming up and carrying proudly a tray on which was toast of an incredible blackness, and a pot which smelled feebly of tea. "The next time you're out of a cook, just send for me," he said cheerfully. Mrs. Wheeler, full and overflowing with indignation and the peace of her mind she had meant to deliver, retired vanquished to her bedroom. Late that night, when Nina had finally forgiven him and had settled down for sleep, Leslie went downstairs for a cigar to find Elizabeth sitting there alone, a book on her knee, face down, and her eyes wistful and with a question in them. "Sitting and thinking, or just sitting?" he inquired. "I was thinking." "Air castles, eh? Well, be sure you put the right man into them." He felt more or less a fool for having said that, for it was extremely likely that Nina's family was feeling some doubt about Nina's choice. "What I mean is," he added hastily, "don't be a fool and take Wally Sayre. Take a man while you're about it." "I would, if I could do the taking." "That's piffle, Elizabeth." He sat down on the arm of a chair and looked at her. "Look here, what about this story the Rossiter girl and a few others are handing around about Dick Livingstone? You're not worrying about it, are you?" "I don't believe it's true, and it wouldn't matter to me anyhow." "Good for you," he said heartily, and got up. "You'd better go to bed, young lady. It's almost midnight." But although she rose, she made no further move to go. "What I am worrying about is this, Leslie. He may hear it." "He has heard it, honey." He had expected her to look alarmed, but instead she showed relief. "I'll tell you the truth, Les," she said. "I was worrying. I'm terribly fond of him. It just came all at once, and I couldn't help it. And I thought he liked me, too, that way." She stopped and looked up at him to see if he understood, and he nodded gravely. "Then today, when he came to see Nina, he avoided me. He, I was waiting in the hall upstairs, and he just said a word or two and went on down."
"Poor devil," Leslie said. "You see, he's in an unpleasant position, to say the least. But here's a thought to go to sleep on. If you ask me, he's keeping out of your way, not because he cares too little, but because he cares too much." Long after a repentant and chastened Leslie had gone to sleep, his arm over Nina's unconscious shoulder, Elizabeth stood wide-eyed on the tiny balcony outside her room. From it, in daylight, she could see the Livingston house. Now it was invisible, but an upper window was outlined in the light. Very shyly, she kissed her fingertips to it. "Good night, dear," she whispered. End of chapter 14.
Chapter 15 of The Breaking Point by Mary Roberts Reinhardt. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Louis Bassett had left for Norada the day after David's sudden illness, but 10 days later found him only as far as Chicago and laid up in his hotel with a sprained knee. It was not until the day Nina went back to the little house in the Ridgely Road, having learned the first lesson of married life, that men must not only be captured but also held, that he was able to resume his journey. He had chafed wretchedly under the delay. It was true that nothing in the way of a story had broken yet. The Tribune had carried a photograph of the cabin where Clark had, according to the Donaldson woman, spent the winter following the murder, and there were the usual reports that he had been seen recently in spots as diverse as Seattle and New Orleans. But when the following Sunday brought nothing further, he surmised that the pack, having lost the scent, had been called off. He confirmed this before starting west by visiting some of the offices of the leading papers and looking up old friends. The Clark story was dead for the time. They had run a lot of pictures of him, however, and someone might turn him up eventually, but a scent was pretty cold in 10 years. The place had changed, too. Oil had been discovered 5 years ago, and the old settlers had, a good many of them, cashed in and moved away. The town had grown like all oil towns. Bassett was fairly content. He took the night train out of Chicago and spent the next day crossing Nebraska, fertile, rich, and interesting. On the afternoon of the second day he left the train and took a branch line toward the mountains and Norada, and from that time on he became an urbane, interested, and generally cigar-smoking interrogation point. "Railroad been here long?" he asked the conductor.
4 years.
"Norada must have been pretty isolated before that."
30 miles in a coach or a Ford car."
"I was reading the other day," said Bassett, "about the Judson Clark case. Have a cigar? Got time to sit down?"
"You a newspaper man?"
"Oil well supplies," said Bassett easily. "Well, in this article it seemed some woman or other had made a confession. It sounded fishy to me."
"Well, I'll tell you about that."
The conductor sat down and bit off the end of his cigar. "I knew the Donaldsons well, and Maggie Donaldson was an honest woman. But I'll tell you how I explained the thing. Donaldson died, and that left her pretty much alone. The executors of the Clark estate kept her on the ranch, but when the estate was settled 3 years ago, she had to move. That broke her all up. She always said he wasn't dead. She kept the house just as it was, and my wife said she had his clothes all ready and everything."
"That sounds rather as though the story is true, doesn't it?"
"Not necessarily. It's my idea she got from hoping to moping, so to speak. She went into town regular for letters for 10 years, and the postmaster says she never got any. She was hurt in front of the post office. The talk around here is that she's been off her head for the last year or two."
"But they found the cabin."
"Sure they did," said the conductor equably. "The cabin was no secret. It was an old fire station before they put the new one on Goat Mountain. I spent a month in it myself once, with the dude who wanted to take pictures of bear. We found a bear, but it charged the camera, and I'd be running yet if I hadn't come to civilization."
When he had gone, Bassett fell into deep thought. So Maggie Donaldson had gone to the post office for 10 years. He tried to visualize those faithful, wearisome journeys through spring mud and winter snow, always futile and always hopeful. He did not for a moment believe that she had gone off her head.
She had been faithful to the end, as some women were, and in the end, too, as had happened before, her faith had killed her. And again he wondered at the curious ability of some men to secure loyalty. They might go through life tearing down ideals and destroying illusions to the last, but always there was some faithful hand to rebuild, some faithful soul to worship. He was somewhat daunted at the size and bustling activity of Norada. Its streets were paved and well lighted. There were a park and a public library, and the clerk at the commercial hotel asked him if he wished a private bath. But the development was helpful in one way. In the old Norada, a newcomer might have been subjected to a friendly but inquisitive interest. In this grown-up and self-centered community, a man might come and go unnoticed. And he had other advantages. The pack, as he cynically thought of them, would have started at the Clark Ranch and the cabin. He would get to them, of course, but he meant to start on the outside of the circle and work in. "Been here long?" he asked the clerk at the desk, after a leisurely meal. The clerk grinned. "I came here 2 years ago. I never saw Jud Clark. To get to the Clark place, take the road north out of town and keep straight about 8 miles. The road's good now. You fellows have worn it smooth."
"Must have written that down and learned it off," Bassett said admiringly. "What the devil's the Clark place, and why should I go there? Unless," he added, "they serve a decent meal."
"Sorry." The clerk looked at him sharply, was satisfied, and picked up a pen. "You'll hear the story if you stay around here any time. Anything I can do for you?"
"Yes, fire the cook," Bassett said, and moved away.
He spent the evening in going over his notes and outlining a campaign, and the next day he stumbled on a bit of luck. His elderly chambermaid had lived in and around the town for years.
"Ever hear of any Livingstons in these parts?" he asked.
"Why, yes, there used to be a Livingston ranch at Dry River," she said, pausing with her carpet sweeper and looking at him. "It wasn't much of a place, although you can't tell these days. I sold 60 acres 8 years ago for $2,000, and the folks that bought it are getting $1,000 a day out of it."
She sighed. She had touched the hem of fortune's garment and passed on. For some, opportunity knocked but faintly, and for others it burst open the door and forced its way in.
"I'd be a millionaire now if I'd held on," she said somberly. That day Bassett engaged a car by the day, he to drive it himself and return it in good condition, the garage to furnish tires.
"I'd just like to say one thing," the owner said as he tried the gears. "I don't know where you're going, and it's not exactly my business. Here in the oil country, where they're cutting each other's throats for new leases, we let a man alone. But if you've any idea of taking that car by the back road to the old fire station, where Jud Clark's supposed to have spent the winter, I'll just say this. We've had two stuck up there for a week, and the only way I see to get them back is a cyclone."
"I'm going to Dry River," Bassett said shortly.
"Dry River's right if you're looking for oil. Go easy on the brakes, old man. We need them in our business."
Dry River was a small settlement away from the railroad. It consisted of two intersecting unpaved streets, a dozen or so houses, a closed and empty saloon, and two general stores. He chose one at random and found that the old Livingston place had been sold 10 years ago on the death of its owner, Henry Livingston.
"His brother from the East inherited it," said the storekeeper. "He came and sold out, lock, stock, and barrel. Not that there was much. A few cattle and horses, and the stuff in the ranch house, which wasn't valuable. There were a lot of books, and the brother gave them for a library, but we haven't any building. The railroad isn't built this far yet, and unless we get oil here, it won't be."
"The brother inherited it, eh? Do you know the brother's name?"
"David, I think. He was a doctor back east somewhere."
"Then this Henry Livingston wasn't married, or at least had no children?"
"He wasn't married. He was a sort of a hermit. He'd been dead 2 days before anyone knew it. My wife went out when they found him and got him ready for the funeral. He was buried before the brother got here."
He glanced at Bassett shrewdly. "The place has been prospected for oil, and there's a dry hole on the next ranch. I tell my wife nature's like the railroad. It quit before it got this far."
Bassett's last scruple had fled. The story was there, ready for the gathering.
so ready, indeed, that he was almost suspicious of his luck. And that conviction, that things were coming too easy, persisted through his interview with the storekeeper's wife in the small house behind the store. She was a talkative woman, eager to discuss the one drama in a drab life, and she showed no curiosity as to the reason for his question. "Henry Livingstone," she said, "well, I should say so. I went out right away when we got the word he was dead, and there I stayed until it was all over. I guess I know as much about him as anyone around here does, for I had to go over his papers and find out who his people were." The papers, it seemed, had not been very interesting, cancelled checks and receipted bills, and a large bundle of letters, all of them from a brother named David and a sister who signed herself Lucy. There had been a sealed one, too, addressed to David Livingstone, and to be opened after his death. She had had her husband wire to David, and he had come out too late for the funeral. "Do you remember when that was?" "Let me see. Henry Livingstone died about a month before the murder at the Clark Ranch. We date most things around here from that time." "How long did David stay?" Bassett had tried to keep his tone carefully conversational, but he saw that it was not necessary. She was glad of a chance to talk. "Well, I'd say about 3 or 4 weeks. He hadn't seen his brother for years, and I guess there was no love lost. He sold everything as quick as he could and went back east." She glanced at the clock. "My husband will be in soon for dinner. I'll be glad to have you stay and take a meal with us." The reporter thanked her and declined. "It's an interesting story," he said. "I didn't tell your husband, for I wasn't sure I was on the right trail. But the David and Lucy business eliminates this man. There's a piece of property waiting in the East for a Henry Livingstone who came to this state in the 80s, or for his heirs. You can say positively that this man was not married?" "No, he didn't like women. Never had one on the place. Two ranch hands that are still at the Wassons and himself, that was all. The Wassons are the folks who bought the ranch." No housekeeper, then, and no son born out of wedlock, so far as any evidence went. All that glib lying in the doctor's office, all that apparent openness and frankness, gone by the board. The man in the cabin, reported by Maggie Donaldson, had been David Livingstone. Somehow, some way, he had got Judson Clark out of the country and spirited him east. Not that the how mattered just yet. The essential fact was there, that David Livingstone had been in this part of the country at the time Maggie Donaldson had been nursing Judson Clark in the mountains. Bassett sat back and chewed the end of his cigar thoughtfully. The sheer boldness of the scheme which had saved Judson Clark compelled his admiration, but the failure to cover the trail, the ease with which he had picked it up, made him suspicious. He rose and threw away his cigar. "You say this David went east when he had sold the place? Do you remember where he lived?" "Some town in eastern Pennsylvania. I've forgotten the name." "I've got to be sure I'm wrong and then go ahead," he said as he got his hat. "I'll see those men at the ranch, I guess, and then be on my way. How far is it?" It was about 10 miles along a bad road which kept him too much occupied for any connected thought. But his sense of exultation persisted. He had found Judson Clark. End of chapter 15.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.